Welcome back, everyone, to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kessner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. As our regular listeners know, it is my job to provide some information about what to do if listening to this podcast is difficult or emotional for you. Sometimes it can be difficult to hear. So we encourage all of you to care for your safety and your well-being. Please reach out for emotional support from family or friends, a counselor if you have one, or even a hotline. We'll give you the address of the Take Back the Night Foundation at the end of the podcast, and you can get resources there as well.
Thank you so much, Claire. And today, our special guest goes by Sam. And Sam, we're delighted to have you on the show. And we always start out kind of asking a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, you know, just anything about your schooling, your hobbies, your interests, your family, anything you'd like to share to give us kind of your personal backdrop of life so far.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. My name is Sam. I grew up in Massachusetts, Lowell and Westford mostly. And after high school, I moved to Merrimack, New Hampshire, and we've been here for about 12 years. I work as an estimator at a union furniture installation company in Littleton, and I've been in that job for about 8 years, and it's great. I love it. Hobbies. I really like art. I like to draw. I like to paint. I like to read. I'm very introverted, so my hobbies are pretty introverted. But yeah, I just live with, it's just me and my cat in my apartment, and my family actually lives pretty much across the street. So that's nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I like
it. That's super helpful.
Yeah. It's great being close to my family. It's important to me. So
how old is your cat?
Sting is 8.
Sting.
Yeah, she's getting up there. Yeah.
I know. Claire's a big cat person, and I only had one cat once who was a stray.
Oh.
And mewing at my door on a cold and blustery night. And so I got some whatever food I could find and put it out there, and then I named her Sheba, and she would not leave.
Oh, my God.
So it was impossible. She didn't even want to go outside again.
Yeah, that would be something I would do, though.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And we always start out kind of with the experience, the survivor story that brings you to your microphone before we kind of get into your healing journey, you know, a little bit about what happened in your life to bring you at this point to this microphone.
Sure. So after high school, I went to Johnson & Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island. They had a pretty tailored counseling psychology program. And I had always loved psychology. It's something that I really enjoyed in school. So I applied and I got in, and it was a pilot program. So there was kind of a select number of students that were in it, but it was great. And my sophomore year of college, I was still living in the dorm, and it was, I think there were like 9 girls. It was like a suite in the dorm. And I had a very small circle of friends because I'm usually the quiet one and I'm not very outgoing. So I really relied on that small circle. And one of my friends, she was definitely more outgoing, more of a social butterfly. And there was this kid that I had a crush on, and she was kind of mutually friends with him. So one night, it was November 10th, 2013, we went to the mall to watch a movie at Providence Place Mall. I don't know if you've been there, but it's huge. It's 3 floors. And they have a movie theater inside. And then he was in a fraternity, and we went back to his house after the movie was over. And they lived in a frat house that's up on Fed Hill. And it's kind of, there's just a lot of fraternities in that area, a lot of parties going on, restaurants. It's just a very busy, busy area. And my friend had a crush on one of his friends. So it was kind of like she was with him and I was with this other guy. And we went back to the house and had a couple drinks. And then she went in one room with her boyfriend, and I went into another room with this guy. And things just got out of hand pretty quickly. And he ended up sexually assaulting me. And I feel like I kind of disassociated pretty quickly because I just remember staring at the wall, and he had this like tapestry hanging covering almost the whole wall, and it was orange and black. I couldn't even tell you what it was, but it was kind of my focal point until it was over. And I felt like I was yelling no, like pretty loudly. And after it was over,
Wait, look, Sam, I know I'm interrupting at a big moment.
That's okay.
You've been talking about a lot of things, and I wanted to make sure we went back and talked about a few of them in more detail, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
I know the part you're about to share is part of reliving your trauma, just to share it with our listeners. So I want to give you support as you do that, but also just kind of going back to thinking through that whole night and the friend and all the people around and the context, just to help our listeners know a little bit about you and what, you know, put you in this place. Like, was partying at the fraternity houses something new to you? Was it something you enjoyed? I mean, just kind of what was your, I know I'll always say it this way, Sam, like when I went off to college, my college, William and Mary has a big, strong Greek system with houses established in brick and mortar on the campus. And the fraternity and sorority life had a tremendous impact on the overall, I would say, social life at the school, as well as the power of the students. If you were a Greek life person, you had instantly more power as those GDIs, which I was. And so, and I came into college like feeling already like I couldn't afford it. It was more sophisticated of a lifestyle that I really understood, having gone to public school in Cal Valley in Pennsylvania. And my parents didn't have the background and experience of wealthy college anything, you know, they barely told me anything about it. So I think what's interesting to me too is maybe talking a little bit about what you perceived yourself going into this situation, because this was your sophomore year, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you'd been there, and I think going back to the kind of when you started and where you were at this point is really interesting, and it might help our listeners who are either in college environments or considering them or are reliving their own past, you know, maybe how you felt and what it was like at your institution. You were at the Johnson & Wales that's in Rhode Island?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely, like, there wasn't as big of a Greek life as you're describing. Like, we didn't have those brick and mortar houses with the signs on the outside.
How did it feel though? Like, I guess
it was.
So talk about both that and also kind of how it felt to go to those parties, what they meant, who went, who didn't go.
Yeah.
The whole picture would be really interesting because that's the backdrop to your experience.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Honestly, I never really enjoyed going to the parties because it did feel like a huge imbalance of power. And it was uncomfortable for me. I was very quiet. I didn't really enjoy being in loud places with a ton of people. Like, it was fun freshman year. You know, we'd get into, like I said, so Fed Hill was maybe like 15 minutes from the actual main campus. So you'd have to get a ride or walk to go up there. But normally we'd get a ride. And my closest friend that I had met freshman year, like I said, she was very outgoing. So I went to a lot of parties with her because of her kind of connections, but she wasn't in the Greek life. She just knew a lot of people in it. So a lot of parties that we went to were frat and sorority houses. But like I said, it was, I never really found it fun. I kind of just was that one that was like, kind of waiting for it to be over so we could go home.
Sam, another quick question about this.
Yeah.
Was there any, outside of the Greek system, was there any other kind of social life at the campus for people who just, you know, weren't into that stuff? Did people gather? Were there other activities, opportunities, or, you know, what was it like if you weren't into that stuff?
Honestly, there wasn't much going on. Like, we had sports, but never been athletic, so that didn't appeal to me. I was very into my studies. Like, I was kind of a nerd. I loved school. I loved the program. So I mostly kept to myself.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot going on.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
And what was the, I also think, like, what was the party size? Was there much diversity? Was it known to go to a certain house for certain types of experiences or certain interactions? And I'm also curious, since they were so far away, what was the alcohol and or drug situation?
Yeah. It was always extremely crowded. Like, the houses would be so full that you would be like in the backyard with other people and going up and down the stairs. It was crazy. It's kind of like what you see in the movies. There was just always a ton of people around. And we definitely had our people. Like, my friend at the time, she was usually with somebody older. So that's where we would, you know, get marijuana or alcohol. It was never a struggle to get what we needed. And also, they weren't very diligent, you know, going to the stores and checking IDs. That was kind of the fun of being there. They didn't really care if a minor was buying alcohol. So yeah, we always had what we needed when we were going to those parties.
I'm assuming the parties were at fraternities. Were there parties at sororities, or is it just fraternities?
There were parties at sororities, but they weren't really as much fun. It was kind of, the houses like switched off. So sometimes the sorority house would hold a party and like all the guys would go there, and sometimes it was the other way around. Mm-hmm. But
why do you say they weren't so much fun? Was it lack of bands, lack of alcohol, not more men than women, or like what made them not as much fun in your opinion?
In my experience, the girls that were in the sororities just weren't very nice. It was a very exclusive feeling thing, and if you were on the outside of that, it was uncomfortable.
Huh. So in this instance, in your situation, it wasn't a party you went to, really. It was just you went back to the house with the guy you were with.
Right. Yeah.
When you got there, was it the kind of thing where you had to go upstairs to a room, or was it, how did that work?
No, I believe it was a one-story house. You just walked in. There was a living room to the right, and then mm-hmm. a little narrow kitchen and two bedrooms at the back.
Okay. And what was your expectation when you went back to the fraternity house? What were you thinking would happen?
I was thinking that hopefully I would get a kiss from a guy that I liked and we'd go from there. I absolutely did not have the expectation that things would go the way that they did.
And also, Sam, do you think your friend had different expectations from you about why she was going back?
She might have. She had been dating the other guy for maybe about a month. So they had a lot more of like a relationship than I did with the guy that I was with.
Okay.
Was your friend someone who would talk to you about, you know, I'm just envisioning, Sam, something like almost like a movie scene where the two guys plan out, like, what are you going to, like, they could have made a bet, like, I'm going to get this. Do you think they were in, you know, cahoots with each other, or do you think they didn't that wasn't part of it. I'm just curious, like now, if you now think about your friend mindset, your mindset, what is your perception of the two guys?
Looking back on it, I absolutely believe that that was probably the expectation between the two of them, that we were going to all go back to the house, do our separate things, and then leave. So it absolutely feels like they could have kind of had that Kahoot rapport thing going between the two of them regarding me and my other friend.
Mm-hmm. And if you're comfortable answering this, I mean, what had been, since you talked about yourself as being shy, had you had much experience dating prior to this?
No, in high school, I dated one guy off and on for about 4 years, and he actually had a drug problem. And so getting into the counseling psychology program was important to me because I had seen what he was going through, and it just made me want to help people and understand it further. And then in my sophomore year, later after this happened, he ended up passing away from an overdose. So I definitely was not the kind of person that always had a boyfriend in high school, was like dating guys on the football team. It wasn't like that at all. So I would say at this point, I didn't have a lot of experience in that arena.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that part, Sam. So now, like, sorry, I let you go for a long while. Now I'm just talking about you. But to me, it's like we want to put together the whole puzzle of what happened, because thinking it through with our listeners is often really helpful for them and even for our guests. Like, sometimes we hope that we'll, you know, think about something you might not have considered before. So my next one is kind of, we asked about your mindset, but there's also the practicality. You said you had to get there 15 minutes away. I think you said 15 minutes, right?
Yeah.
So how, what was your plan to get home?
So we walked to the mall. We all met at the mall. The boys drove, and the expectation was that we were going to get a ride home with them and probably go back to the house and hang out for a bit.
And would they be the ones driving you home, or had you not even talked about it?
No, they would be the ones driving us home.
So they had said, oh yeah, come back here and we'll take you home later?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
And it's not really funny, but I remember being in the car, leaving the mall and heading up to Fed Hill. We were listening to, it was Kesha. And I think this song was like, Die Young. That's what it was. And now every time I hear that song, it's like all I can picture is being in the car. It's weird.
Oh, that's very normal, Sam. Yeah. it's actually part of the whole, my belief, Sam, and I've mentioned this a couple times, is when we have high trauma, all five senses become indelibly imprinted with those kind of stamps of what we heard, what we smelled, what we saw, what we felt, like physical touch. Like if you are wearing, I'll just give you an example. I bet if you are wearing some really unique fuzzy sock, you know, like instead of, or tube socks, or if you had no, you know, if there's, I can use socks as an example. Every time you wore these weird tube socks, you'd be like, oh, this is high risk, high trauma. I don't like tube socks.
Yeah.
I don't like the way they feel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I definitely
cool.
do.
Well, we can explore that a little bit more. Claire, before we head into the fraternity situation, is there anything else you can think of in terms of the 360 experience?
No, I think Sam has shared a lot, actually, and what I wanted to know.
Thanks.
So here we are. When things got out of hand, and you said you're sure you said no many times. Do you recall, well, one thing we know about the kinds of rapists that you describe, which are the sort of, you know, acquaintance rapists, I would say.
Yeah.
Is that their primary MO is to ignore the person they're with.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that, you know, then they have to say, well, did you communicate well? It sounds like you may have. What was his response when you were saying no to him?
It was just, it was nothing. It was, mm-hmm. it was dead silence. And I, yeah, it, there was no response.
If he didn't say anything, Sam, did he do something with his body or how he looked at you or touched you when you asked him? Like, what was all the non-spoken language he was using?
It was power, I would say. He wasn't tall. He was probably the same height as me, but he had a broad figure. And I would say the non-spoken language was like domineering, kind of like, you're here because you like me. I'm in a frat. It was kind of what we talked about earlier. Like, it just felt like a power imbalance. And when I started to draw back, the touch just got more aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. And I'm also, you're, and Sam, oh my gosh, thank you for being so brave and talking about so many small details, because you are helping so many people understand their own trauma and what they went through when we all kind of, I kind of think of it as we're team thinking.
Yeah.
We're all on the same team and we're kind of all team thinking. Every episode is one of our team members doing a deeper dive, a very challenging dive into what happened and how we're going to think about how we understand that healing journey too.
Yeah.
So my question then becomes, I think, you know, I can totally picture him and all the things he's doing. The next, this is very subtle, but now I'm picturing if you two are clearly about the same height, he's broader, you know, he's wider, mm-hmm. he's thicker. I'm just picturing a wider, thicker human. But what part of his, what was he touching? Do you, I mean, I don't want to gross you
That's
out,
okay.
But I sometimes think men will touch certain parts of the body that they know are almost going to produce certain sensations or responses.
Yeah.
And they, it, much like you talk your way into it, you can also feel your way into what you want. You can talk your way into it with words. But he wasn't using words, mm-hmm. but maybe he was using his, the way he was touching you and where and how.
Yeah.
Because you said you perceived it as more aggressive. And now I'm like wondering about that nuance mm-hmm. of how he might've been using touch instead of words to manipulate you.
Yeah, no, it was, he had his hand like on my waist and occasionally he'd kind of move it to my lower back. And when I pulled back or when I shifted kind of the direction of my body, like more facing towards the door, like that's where I wanted to go, he would just step towards me while simultaneously pushing me back. Like he wasn't pushing me, but his hand on my waist, like he was almost guiding me, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I do. And I bet he did he do it in sort of a sort of powerful, but trying to be sexy way?
Yes.
Almost like it, I'm just envisioning, he is so good at that. He knows how to use mm-hmm. this, I'm Romeo and you're my, not, that's not bad. He's not.
Ooh, right.
Romeo, you're not, he's not a good Romeo.
Yeah. No.
I always picture Romeo as like being kind of nice.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of him as, you know, being the ultimate, knowing how to touch someone in the most orchestrated, mind manipulating, body manipulating way. He sounds like he was perfect at doing this. Do you think that was, that describes him?
Absolutely. He was like Rico Suave. Like I think when that dynamic between a man and a woman, like you want to feel almost mm-hmm. like protected
mm-hmm.
and he used his presence to kind of overcome me. And
that's so interesting.
And this is while you were standing up, it sounds like.
Yes.
You were
yeah.
in the room and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have you standing up. So how does he finally overcome any sort of, you know, idea in your head that I can leave. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big switch, Sam. Like,
yeah,
there must have been a moment when you didn't pursue, because I kind of hear you saying I was mentally pursuing courses of action. Mm-hmm. Like, one was, I don't want this, I want to leave. Mm-hmm. So then you were looking at the door to hint, hint, I want to leave. Mm-hmm. So like many of us, we hint, hint at something and, you know, we're trying to be nice and kind and not piss anyone off, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Because we don't know what can happen next. So you tried. Phase one was look at the door, mm-hmm. and hint, hint, and use the physical touch. So that was phase one. What was phase two like?
Phase two was, you know, I still like him. It's not like I didn't want to hook up with him at that point, but I think simultaneous, like you said, I kind of still had that phase one, like, if it gets out of hand, I want to leave. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down on the bed and we started kissing. And then it's like, you kind of lay back and it sounds weird.
Do you remember how he got you to the bed?
We were standing, the room was very small. So when we were kind of standing in the doorway, it was like two steps to the bed. So you'd basically take a step and sit down.
Okay. Gotcha.
So
that totally makes sense. Hello, dorm room.
I know, right? Yeah. It definitely wasn't like leading you from one room to another.
And did he pull you onto the bed or he pushed you onto the bed?
No, he pulled me. It wasn't a push at this point. Like, so it's like, yeah, like you were saying, that pull still feels a little bit sexy.
I think that's really interesting because to me, what I'm hearing about this rapist is mm-hmm. he is so good. He has his own like justification of power and control. Like,
yes.
If I just slightly manipulate her and don't push her, shove her, force her, mm-hmm. if I don't answer, I'm not guilty if I don't speak.
Yes.
Right. I pretend I don't hear no. Mm-hmm. I pretend that I don't notice body language. But so he has boundaries, because that's what I was actually, as Sam, you were describing it, I was like thinking he probably didn't push you, because that would be not, mm-hmm. he thinks that would be wrong. But he doesn't think, he thinks it's romantic if mm-hmm. he just he's the magnet. He's not the push, like, you know, the magnetism. He's mm-hmm. not the reverse ion. He doesn't want to push you. He wants to pull you in. Like, opposites attract. So he's not, he operates with that. Like, I'm the big plus and you will mm-hmm. be the minus that comes over to me because you have to have me. You're the weak, negative ion.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's that notion that of masculine that his, the being overpowered is a woman's fantasy, mm-hmm. and that the kind of resistance you were presenting to him. A lot of guys, when they're asked this in surveys, they'll say, well, you know, if someone doesn't want something, A, you either give them more alcohol, or B, you know, you just keep persisting. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a friend of mine ran a group for adolescent sex offenders. And one guy said, if a woman says no 9 times, then I know she doesn't want to have sex. And my friend said, how did you come up with that number?
Yeah, where did 9 come
and
from?
And he just said, I made it up, right? He doesn't communicate it to the other person.
Yeah.
But it's the idea is that exactly what we're talking about.
Kind of wear someone down.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So here we are.
Yeah, so now he's pulled you, mm-hmm. romanced you, and gotten you on the bed, and you're kissing him to try and placate something. I'm also hearing kind of you were astute enough, for sure, to think I can just do X and he will figure out that I don't want to do more than that.
Yeah.
But then you do X and he wants Y and Z.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel, or much more? So how does that feel and how does that negotiation happen next?
Absolutely. I think, like you said, in my mind, I was just had an idea of where I wanted it to stop. And exactly like you just said, you know, you give them that inch and all of a sudden it becomes a mile and it happens like in the blink of an eye. All of a sudden it was just, it had moved from A to Z. Mm-hmm. It was very, very quick.
So all this happens. What happened next? How did you get out of that situation?
So I stayed and I laid on the bed in the dark, and my clothes were on the floor, and he got up and literally left the house and didn't come back.
Where did he left, like, physically?
He left,
like,
you there?
Walked out in the car?
Yeah, I don't know where he went, but he...
Oh my God, did he go by himself, Sarah?
Yeah, he did. It was...
That's...
It was...
Whoa.
It was very bizarre.
That's crazy.
He just got up and left, because the next morning when my friend came in, she's like, where is he? And I was like, I don't know. He left. I don't know where he went.
Do you know where he went to this day?
No.
Oh my God, Sam. That is psycho.
So I just think, like, in my head, obviously, I know now, like, this was 10 years ago, but even at the time, I was like, you know that you did something very wrong.
Mm-hmm. I right now, Sam, not to be, like, silly, but I'm so pissed. I'm thinking he either went to the church and prayed for his soul,
yeah,
or he went to his other girlfriend, mm-hmm, that he has a kid with.
Like, yeah, I know.
He's a psycho predator.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I know.
He had to do one or the other. Like, where else? He lived there. That was his room.
That was his home. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think he had parents nearby? Like, did he go home and beg to mama?
From what I understand,
I'm just so mad right now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You can hear my voice. I'm so pissed right now. I'm like, wow, I now know a rapist who rapes the girl, leaves him in his room, and just thinks he can jump ship.
I know. And I don't, from what I understand, I think he lived in New Jersey. So I'm
okay.
Probably
maybe he drove his ass to New Jersey.
I don't know.
Oh my God.
It was just wild. I was like, I have no idea to this day where he went.
And what was your friend's response when you told her he just left?
Yeah. So what did she say?
Her response, when I told her what had happened, because this was in the morning, I didn't get off that bed all night. Like, it was like I was paralyzed. And she came in the next morning and was kind of like, hey, how was your night? And I was like, you didn't hear me yelling? And she was like, no. Mm. And I was like, I felt like I was screaming. And so I had told her what happened, and her response was, he's too nice to do that. You must have misunderstood.
Oh, my gosh, Sam.
And so, and then when I was like, I don't know where he is, he left the house. She just kind of was like, well, the whole thing must have been a misunderstanding.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
And
please tell me that you never spoke with her ever again. What happened next with her?
So she was my closest friend. And
I know, you said that.
Yeah, so it was extremely difficult, because I went home to the dorm, and I don't know how many showers I took, but any evidence that this had happened was gone.
Oh.
And I just knew that I couldn't report it, and I just wasn't going to bring it forward because I had no support. And I knew that I couldn't do it alone.
When you say had no support, it was just your definition at that moment, which I think will help. It will help our listeners. I hear what you said, but explaining what your definition of I had no support at that point. Like, remember you said your family lives across the street right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just asking, can you explain to our listeners what that meant to you?
Sure. To me, it just meant the support of my best friends, mm-hmm, because I was not in a place where I was ready to share it with my family. I was still processing what happened, and I didn't have a lot of friends. So she was it. So if she didn't believe me, like, I didn't have support from her in Rhode Island, because my family was up in New Hampshire. So it was like she was kind of it for me. And after she said that, I was like, what do I have?
Yeah.
Mm, that's so, maybe we could spend a little bit of time now, Sam, talking about how that relationship deteriorated and what happened.
Sure.
And, you know, she was, hello, now she's in a relationship with a guy who's fraternity brothers and best friends with your rapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did that happen? What happened there?
We didn't speak after that. I kind of reached out to the roommate that I had my freshman year. Mm-hmm. We were really good friends freshman year, and then things kind of deteriorated, not because of anything in particular, just we kind of hung out in different groups. So I reached out to her for support, and she didn't say she outright didn't believe me, but it wasn't the response I was looking for.
I'm sorry that happened, but let's talk. Actually, that's a really important part. I don't want you to give away the, and before I ask you about the whole thing, that let's just do it in steps.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really interesting that you then looked for another human that you had some relationship and trust with, and you've told her, and what was her, other than knowing you, what was her understanding of the fraternity or these two people, the boy, two men in the fraternity and your current friend? Like, what was, if you had to say, she was coming at this from what perspective and what knowledge?
Sure. So she was actually in a sorority.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
no.
She definitely knew these two guys, but she wasn't friends with my close friend. We were in very different circles.
Okay. But she's Greek and you and your friend are not.
Yeah.
So hello. That's how I started, remember, the DKI.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting. So then you came back to her, and how did you broach it with her? Like, in person? Did you text her? Did you call her?
I texted her.
And you said, can we talk? Or what was the, how did you say it?
I just came right out and said it. I was like, this happened last night at his house. I was with my close friend, and her response was a little bit detached, but I think she still cared about me a lot. It was mostly just, I'm really sorry you had to go through that. I'm here if you need me.
Okay. Neutral at best.
Yeah, right.
Neutral at best? That's what I would say. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, I would agree. It was neutral.
Yeah, I hear that. And again, I just want to tell you are amazing. This interview is fabulous. I'm so honored and delighted you reached out to us and wanted to have this conversation. You're so clear, and we are enamored. Claire and
thank
I,
you.
We answer really specific. We ask you a lot of specific questions, and you have been so honest and helpful with every answer. I'm just thinking, in our last 10, 11 minutes with you, what else should we talk about, Claire? What do you think?
Well, I'd like to know something about your recovery process.
Sure.
Before, how about, Claire, we ask that second, but I just want to close the story. So we left it with, you did not, this happened sophomore year. You then still graduated from Johnson & Wales.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you changed up your entire friend group?
Yeah. I really, after this had all happened, I isolated myself even further, and I just threw myself into my schoolwork because I loved this program. And in my head, I was like, you're not forcing me out of here. Like, I knew if I brought it forward, another aspect of that was that it would be a he said, she said, and I would likely have to transfer schools.
Did you have to see him?
I did. We were on the same campus, but he was in a different program, and the building was a bit further up than mine was. But I would occasionally see him on the street, but I never ran into him in close proximity until the last trimester when I took an elective science course to just fill out my credits, and class was like half empty. There were a lot of empty desks. And the first day he showed up about 20 minutes late and he sat right behind me. Ugh. And I just was like, it was just him showcasing his power. Mm-hmm. Like, I still have this over you kind of thing.
Wow.
And I got up and left, and I called my freshman year roommate. And she talked me down a little bit. I was having a panic attack. And then I called my parents. I told them what happened, and they immediately drove down to get me.
So they knew, did they know about the assault when it happened, or was this news to them when you called them?
No, this was news to them. I had kept it a secret. My sister knew, and shockingly, she didn't tell my parents. But she was the only one that I had told after it happened.
Okay.
So, but yeah, anyways, back to the question. Yeah. I graduated with honors, and I left, and I really never looked back.
And what is your relationship with your alma mater? Is there any? Or did it?
With my what?
Your alma mater, with Johnson and Wales. You know, schools like to maintain relationships. And this kind of thing really can poison a connection. And I'm just wondering if you...
I left with a really bad taste in my mouth, because that after he sat down behind me in that class and my parents brought me home, my first kind of order of business was to transfer out of that class. And when I called SAS and was trying to get through the process, the woman that I was talking to was really rude and kind of inconsiderate. She kept pressuring me to know like why I was transferring, and I was trying to be as vague as possible. And I basically was like, it's not your business. Like, just get me out of this class. Mm. And so I'm not a part of the Alumni Association. Honestly, when I get their emails, I just report them as spam, because although I was successful and I graduated with honors, it's not a chapter of my life that I want to keep open.
Let's do two more questions. Sam, first of all, I did the same thing with William and Mary's alumni.
Yeah.
I don't write, this is spam. I just say, go back and read my whole life story and tell me that you think you're justified in sending this email. Like, because you have done nothing.
Yeah, I'm like, right.
And I think, you know, after this podcast, Sam, you're entitled to send links to this every time. I say, undo the spam filter, put us in as your response.
Yeah.
Because
I
then
would be
you
happy
might
too.
They're not flies on the wall that you're swatting.
Mm-hmm.
They become scared that the truth is revealed.
Yeah.
We can do this. That's so cool. At least. Let's end on the healing happy notes.
Yeah.
Because you were just simply magnificent, and we're so happy you were here.
Thank you so much.
But I just have two questions about your healing process, and Claire usually has another. Mm-hmm. My first two, you are not that far out. You're living now in New Hampshire with your lovely Sting the cat.
Yeah.
across from your parents. And I think you still have achieved so much. But I have one, my first question is, when you feel triggered, like i.e. Shakira, or I think it was Shakira, right?
Kesha.
Kesha, not Shakira. Kesha.
Who is, of course, herself a survivor.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah,
she is.
I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you hear or experience triggers, what has been most helpful? That's my one. And two is, you know, when you start to reclaim your sense of self and body and sexual being, how's that process looking for you, looking at this point to you?
Yeah.
So one is negotiating and navigating triggers. You don't have to give the whole story. That could be a whole other episode. but it could be at least like two things that have been really huge and helpful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Honestly, one of the biggest things is just sitting with it. When I do get triggered, if I smell something, or like you said, I hear that song from Kesha, most of her music doesn't trigger me because I know that she is a survivor, and I feel that's really empowering. to me. But that one song, when it comes on, I do just get that, like, my heart starts to beat a little faster. And I try, you know, when this first happened, I tried to stuff everything down, which I think is a very normal response. But now...
Wait, you said, I tried to step everything down. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes. Yeah.
What does that mean?
It was like repression. Something
step
came,
everything down.
Like your bury feelings. It?
Like,
yeah.
Like numb it? Like yeah. Try and... How do you do that? How did you do that?
Just distract myself by doing something else.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. So when I first came home, everything sort of stopped. It was like you go from going 100 miles an hour and having a lot of schoolwork, and then you move home and it's like you haven't secured a job yet. Everything, it's like halt. And a lot of these feelings were coming up for me. And I guess when I say I tried to repress them, honestly, I would overeat and then I would undereat. So I definitely mm-hmm. developed a very bad relationship with my body.
I'm so glad you could talk about that.
Yeah.
Do you know why you would do the two big pendulums?
I think it was just a vicious circle of eating to calm myself and then being ashamed of that and overly restricting to make up for it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was coming from a place of like, if my body felt soiled, it didn't feel like something that I had to have respect for.
So beautiful.
I felt really detached from it for a long time. Like, I'm talking years. There were times where it just didn't feel like it was my body. So why do I care to take care of it?
Yeah.
What helped you? Are you reconnected yet or not yet?
No, I am. I started going to therapy twice a week and doing cognitive behavioral therapy, which I found to be extremely helpful. And I actually have developed a couple of autoimmune disorders in the last 10 years. So I've been learning the hard way, mostly, that what you put into your body and the way you treat it has such a huge effect when you're going through that. So it's definitely more important to me to take better care of myself and appreciate that, you know, even though I have tough times, I do have this body that for the most part does what it needs to do.
And your autoimmune illnesses, do you think there may be some connection between those and the trauma you experienced?
Yeah, definitely. So the first one that came up was celiac disease, which basically you carry the gene for it, but it can lay dormant in your body for a very long time until something happens that literally triggers it, which is crazy. But I do believe that the trauma triggered it, because all of a sudden I'd be walking to class and eating my normal breakfast and my stomach would be the size, like I would look 6 months pregnant by the time I got to the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. And I was experiencing a lot of pain. And then I went home and my mom had recently been diagnosed with celiac. She was like, you know what, eat gluten-free for a few days, see how you feel. And I felt like a new person. So now I'm 100% gluten-free.
Wow.
Yeah.
How convenient. And I mean, your mom has it, but that was a convenient thing to have happened.
Yeah, no, it was. So,
go ahead. Yeah, Sam, I'm so proud of you for like thinking, because you're clearly thinking. What I also enjoy about our interview with you and discussion is you're thinking as analytically as you can about what's helpful and hurtful to you. And you're cognizant of what, you know, those roadblocks are. But where would you say you are now on that healing agenda? Like, what's next for you?
I would say that I'm at peace with what happened. I forgave him, because after it happened, it was like For a number of years, I was holding so much hate in my heart, thinking that the more I hated him, somehow it would hurt him. And I, through therapy, just came to the realization that I'm only hurting myself by doing that. So it was really a selfish thing to forgive him, because it was like, I forgive you, I'm letting this go. You're not taking up space in my head anymore. Mm. Wow. So I would say right now I'm just peacefully coexisting with it. I have days where I feel like I'm back at square one, and that can be frustrating, but it also just reminds me how far I have come.
And it sounds like you have.
Yeah, I feel like I have. I try to put out as much positivity as I can and not make myself sick with hatred for someone that doesn't care about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was living in your head.
Yeah, he really was living in my head rent free. Yeah. So not anymore.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well,
Sam, is there anything that you would like our listeners to take away from this? What would you like them to know?
I would like people to know that it's okay to feel what you feel. I was very angry for a long time, and I fantasized about killing him and doing things that are just awful. And I was able to sit with those feelings and move on. So if, you know, you experience a trigger and all of a sudden it's like your senses are going haywire, just know that that's normal. Mm-hmm. Like it's okay. And I absolutely, the biggest thing is don't blame yourself for someone else's transgression, because it is not your fault. It is never your fault.
Wise words.
Yeah, beautiful words to close with, actually. Sam, it's, you know, you've been so patient with our questions and so helpful with your answers. We are just joyful that you had this time with us and our listeners to share and be vulnerable. And, you know, hopefully even this interview will help you along with your own journey. So we are, again, we empower you. Keep going.
Thank you.
And please stay in touch. And if more good things happen and you have more epiphanies about what can be helpful to our listeners, please message us back.
Yeah, I feel really grateful that you guys have given me the opportunity to share this. And I just think it's crucial that people feel less alone.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sam. Claire,
you
can you close it out?
Absolutely. Thank you again, Sam, for sharing your story with us and your wisdom. I know that our listeners will find a lot of great support in what you've said. And thanks also to our volunteers who make this podcast possible. And thank you to all our listeners who are here to bear witness. Help us help other survivors. Please subscribe to the podcast so you know when we're having a new episode drop. And share it far and wide on your social media. And also follow us on ours, on our Facebook and Instagram pages. If you need support but don't know where to find it, visit takebackthenight.org for a list of resources and how to reach our legal support hotline. And remember, everyone, self-care is essential to healing and to thriving.
Thank you so much, Claire. And again, our appreciation back to you, Sam. And
thank
for
you.
Our listeners, please continue to log in and know that every single day might be as Sam said today. Some days are better, some days are worse, but it's a journey and it's worthwhile because every one of us is very worthwhile. So take care and tune in again. Bye.
So long, all.